In 2019, we released the story of the Jenkins County Jane Doe as a two-part series, covering a lot of ground and touching on many social issues. When we remastered our season 4 cases, we wanted to tighten the narrative of her story, mostly because a few details from other cases seemed to get mixed in with hers as it was retold in other places. So, we've streamlined the telling here, and we've included never-before-heard interview clips from our original visit with the GBI's Region 4 office. After our visit, we were told that a number of tips and leads came in, including one that indicated that the Jenkins County Jane Doe may have been a woman who came into town on a Greyhound bus from the West Coast. If that sounds at all familiar to you, please reach out to the GBI's Region 4 office at 912-871-1121. Special Agent in Charge John Durden has since retired from the GBI, and Special Agent Dustin Peaks has moved on to a new assignment within the Bureau. But the Jenkins County Jane Doe's case is still active and open within their office. We're still awaiting more news regarding viable testing options. We're especially hopeful that a blood card might be used, as they've proven to be strong contenders in cases where little evidence is available. And we hope that soon, we'll be releasing another update, that the victim formerly known as the Jenkins County Jane Doe has been identified. This episode contains discussion of crime scene details and discussion of autopsy. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. A dumpster sat at the intersection of Kaiser and Old Perkins Road in Millen. That's a little town in Jenkins County in South Georgia. The area was a little off the highway, somewhere you might pass if you were a local or a trucker who knew a cut-through or two. As then-Sheriff Bobby Womack pointed out, a passerby wouldn't know about the dumpsters. Someone would need to be from the area, or maybe a frequent traveler through it. In 1988, Valentine's Day fell on a Sunday. That afternoon, a local man arrived to sort through the refuse. He'd hoped to find aluminum cans, which went for roughly 22 cents a pound. He wasn't there long enough to collect what he needed, though. Almost as soon as he climbed into that first dumpster, he was hit by a sickening smell. There was a large duffel bag, really more of a suitcase, scattered in plastic bags of garbage. According to the Statesboro Herald, he was curious as to what it contained. He pulled out a pocket knife and cut the bag open. Inside, he saw floral bedding, then black hair and swollen flesh, what he assumed to be human remains. He scrambled out of the dumpster and made a call to the sheriff. The Jenkins County Sheriff's Department was soon on the scene, with arrangements to involve the local GBI office made just as quickly. An autopsy would be performed in Atlanta at the GBI's facilities. The Millen News notes the dumpsters had been emptied the Friday before, and law enforcement estimated that the victim had been there since. Progression of decomposition could only be guessed at on scene, but the level of trash in the dumpster strengthened their estimation. The victim was transported, with the duffel bag still in place. Any attempt to separate the two might have affected evidence collection. The dumpster itself was towed to the department's parking lot so it could be more thoroughly searched. At the scene, then-Sheriff Bobby Womack told the Millen News that the victim was presumed female and, quote, maybe Hispanic or Caucasian. They'd know more when the Atlanta results came back. According to News Channel 6, a GBI agent interviewed in 1988 specifically described the duffel bag and the bedding as follows, quote, a nylon suitcase with a very distinct zipper pattern, steel wheels on the bottom, and no other markings. The woman was wrapped in blankets with an ornate pillow and embroidered flowers, end quote. Of course, That could mean many things. When we visited the GBI ourselves in 2019, we were able to inspect the photos. The sheets themselves were unembroidered. There was also a light blue towel with a butterfly design that hadn't been mentioned elsewhere. The pillow was more like a decorative pillow from a bedding set, pale green with a floral design, and it matched the pattern on the maroon bedspread. Neither are what we'd call embroidered or even ornate, but those are subjective words. Rather, they were covered in a large, swirling satin rosette of fabric, the kind that stands up in stiff peaks like a floral kind of wave. It's very much a young woman or teenager's bedspread, the kind you might buy in a bag set from Target or Kmart or Walmart. The GBI allowed us to release the photos of these items, which are posted on our website. Back to 1988. Over the next few weeks, a scattering of newspaper articles, now only available on microfiche, provided updates. The victim was presumed female. She may have died of asphyxiation, though cause of death could not be determined. She had no obvious wounds. The GBI's medical examiner noted that she was likely of East Asian descent, between 20 and 30, and of average height and weight. Millen and Jenkins County and the surrounding area had a very small Asian population, and no one had been reported missing. No missing persons reports from out of state seemed to be a match for her either. Marla Lawson, who was the then GBI forensic artist, prepared a forensic approximation of the victim. In the picture, the woman's lips are parted, showing slightly crooked teeth. Her long hair hangs down over one shoulder, as if she's just taken it down. She's smiling, just a little. It's a striking drawing. But after it was published, it seems that no one came forward to say, "I know her. I've seen her." And based on the microfiche that we reviewed, news coverage of the woman who became known as the Jenkins County Jane Doe quickly faded. Now, a year after we began, we don't know the identity of the Jenkins County Jane Doe, but we have a better idea of who she could have been, and we have a good answer as to who might have killed her. Law enforcement routinely holds facts of cases back. They need to often, so there's information that can lead to arrest. And in Georgia, there's no sunshine law. Any open case is not subject to a FOIA request. But this time, the GBI invited us to Millen, Georgia, to review the Jenkins County Jane Doe's file. We were given an opportunity to go through it all. We met with Special Agent in Charge John Durden and Agent Dustin Peake, who was recently assigned to the case. They gave us several hours to review all of the material and also agreed to an interview. That's why we're able to give you an actual account of the crime scene and the victim. At the top of the episode, we gave you a description of the Jenkins County Jane Doe's discovery, as reported by the newspapers. But there was more to the story. According to the GBI's files, the man who discovered the Jenkins County Jane Doe was in the dumpster to collect cans, but he wasn't alone. The newspapers left out that his girlfriend sat in the car while he boosted himself into the dumpster. The rest of the story went as reported, except for this. The couple did not call the police straight away. Instead, they went to a friend's house, and the friend returned with them to the dumpster. After he'd seen the body too, then they alerted authorities. There could be many reasons for this, and they don't make the witnesses suspect. Another important note not mentioned in the original reporting was that there had been a small brown car at the dump site when the man and his girlfriend arrived, but it pulled out and headed back toward Millen soon after they arrived. Another important note in the GBI's files. The can-collecting witness was not the first person to arrive at the dumpster that day. The smell had been noticed by at least one other witness who'd left trash there, though they did not investigate. Although the notes are not specific, it's likely this was reported after the discovery became known. There are more notes as to the Jenkins County Jane Doe herself, her condition. The language is removed and exact. She's described as in a tucked position within the bag, which had been wrapped in plastic and in duct tape. After her body was transported to the Crow Hill Funeral Home, law enforcement searched the dumpster. They found a gas can, still partially full. Whether it was related to the crime is not noted, but her body was not burned. Maybe the gas had no relation, but maybe someone had planned on using it. The following year, in Jasper County, South Carolina, another woman was found in a suitcase, this time set on fire. Perhaps the Jenkins County suspect had run out of time. Everything was taken into evidence. The dumpster in question was marked in paint and towed to the sheriff's office, where it could be thoroughly examined. When officers and agents canvassed the neighborhood, they heard at least one mention of a brownish car. Two children reported that they'd been playing in their yard on February 12th. It was about 3:30 p.m. when they heard a scream. It sounded like someone crying out, "My baby, my baby." They saw a vehicle pull off from the dumpster and a white man and woman, maybe older, maybe in their 50s, get out and throw something away. Within a week, the victim was transported to the GBI's main office in Atlanta for examination. There's no way to make an autopsy report sound like anything but what it is, an inventory. But there are a few details that might hint at who she was in life, so we feel they're important to include. The Jenkins County Jane Doe's autopsy notes that, quote, she is likely Asian or Hispanic, like that early news report. There's no mention of Asian Caucasian, though that idea may have been mentioned at the scene to a reporter. No DNA tests were performed at the time. It was 1988. To our knowledge, she was not examined by a forensic anthropologist at the time, as she was not skeletonized. Her state made ancestry difficult to determine, though her hair was, and we saw a picture and degree, as described, thick, coarse, and straight, and dark brown or black. Her build is described as slim, and she had slightly crooked top teeth. A bottom molar had been removed at some point, but it was healed. She was not found with any clothing or jewelry. She's described as having freshly shaven legs. Her feet had been bound, but aside from that, there were no obvious signs of injury. As to cause of death, smothering is a possibility, especially with the pillow, which was included, though it was not marked with blood. The autopsy reports, again, that asphyxiation was likely. She did not test positive for any drugs, and the sexual assault kit came back negative for seminal fluid. We've said this before, but we want to note again, this does not preclude assault. After samples were taken and stored, her body was cremated. This was fairly standard practice in Georgia in 1988, but it's now one of the many challenges that modern investigators face. Even nationwide, there weren't many missing Asian and Pacific Islander women to compare the Jenkins County Jane Doe to. Based on 2019 numbers, Asian and Pacific Islander women make up approximately 3.9% of the total American population. Those surveys didn't have language discussing non-binary respondents, but we've rarely seen that choice offered in major polls. Currently, NamUs lists 251 missing Asian and Pacific Islander women in the United States, and 71 unidentified persons who are presumed Asian and female. Of the Asian population in the United States, there are comparatively few cases of missing and unidentified women. But that's not always a perfect tool, because not all cases make it into NamUs. Of the few Asian and Pacific Islander women in NamUs who might be considered as matches for the Jenkins County Jane Doe, we found few, if any, with media presence. The cases with the most coverage are also the most recent, missing teenagers and young adults who've disappeared in the past 5 years. For some older listings, we couldn't find any coverage at all. Of the women who went missing before February 14, 1988, there were fewer than 10 who, based on age, might be considered against the Jenkins County Jane Doe. Those names were passed on to investigators. Of the 71 unidentified Asian females listed in NamUs at the time of this publication, a startling number are recorded via a single, partial remain. There's a woman's skull uncovered in the evidence vault of a New Jersey prosecutor's office. Another woman's skull was found in the attic of a house in Little Rock, Arkansas, and reported to the police. Other skulls were uncovered by work crews in forests, in a disintegrating burlap sack tangled in tree roots. One skull was found marked with a drawing of a cat and the number 13. Two sets of partial bone remains were discovered a year apart in Pierce County, Washington State. The women, both listed as Asian, are estimated to be in the same age range. In another instance, a femur was found along a Santa Cruz hiking trail. The victim in that case is also listed as possibly, quote, American Indian or Alaskan Native. In some cases, race is undetermined, so numbers in any population are not exact. In others, a decedent may be listed in a variety of ways because investigators aren't sure and they don't want to narrow the field. This means that a case can be cross-referenced as white, Hispanic, Native, Asian, other, even multiple, so that whatever an investigating agency searches, they're more likely to come across the decedent as they're investigating a missing person's case. It comes down to this. Without a skeletal reanalysis and DNA testing, we have no definitive answer as to the Jenkins County Jane Doe's possible ancestry. But based on our discussions with anthropologists and other experts, it seems wise to consider possible matches from a wide range of ethnic groups. How the victim was perceived and how she identified may not have matched perfectly with the categories assigned. Questions about race and ethnicity, what anthropologists and forensic experts discuss as ancestry, are more common in forensic cases than we might imagine. Especially in cases of skeletal reanalysis, a victim's ancestry might be reclassified upon reexamination, especially if they are of multiple ancestries or admixture. But classification in Doe cases can also have a lot to do on where a person is found and how those working a case have been socialized to view race and ethnicity. For instance, one of the many reasons we do not have a full scope of the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women in the Southeast is that many of the victims have not been recognized or classified as such. The Southeast's understanding of who is Indigenous and what that means is not nuanced. Lack of federal and sometimes even state recognition of tribes has been one of the issues, but it dates back much farther than that, to the forced relocation of Southeastern tribes in the 19th century. We've discussed this with Anita Lucchesi of the Sovereign Bodies Institute. It's part of what drove her to start her own database, to keep accurate numbers that aren't reflected in NamUs. It's one of the many facets of what we don't know about cold cases. Not just a lack of understanding about who a victim is individually, but who they are in context. When we sat down with Special Agent in Charge John Durden and Special Agent Dustin Peaks of the GBI, we were able to go through the Jenkins County Jane Doe's files. We discovered that agents had followed up on a number of leads since 1988. In fact, agents who'd been assigned to the case since the 80s had reinvestigated each old lead and kept track of new ones.
First of all, the cold cases with the GBI are never closed. They stay open forever. We have cases going back to the 70s and later than that. We do not have a dedicated person in the office that handles a cold case. Every agent is assigned a portion of cases, meaning one agent may have five cold cases. And they're required to every 3 months or so to give us an update on what they've done on that case. So I say that to say this. an agent will be assigned a cold case, but also on top of that, he's assigned to all his other cases, which come in daily. And so those are the ones that takes precedence. They will come first because of the immediacy of the case. Officer involved shootings, murder cases, child molestations, terrorism cases. And so when he has time or she has time, whoever may have the case, they will go back and work on their cold cases. And if they're extremely busy with new cases, the cold cases will end up suffering. Unless there is a hot lead, there's something comes up like that, office stops. We all work on it. We go after it. And in this case, if someone called and said, I know the identity of the victim, she lives in Florida, I'll send two or three agents down there, take what they're doing, stop it, send them and investigate the hot lead.
Can you give us a general estimation of how many current cases agents are looking into in addition to the cold cases they're assigned?
Each agent has their own list of cases. They're anywhere from 12 cases open at a time to up to 20 or 30. Some open cases that they have. And that also includes the ones that are pending court.
At least some of the tips we discovered in the GBI file reported the victim as possibly Latina. One described a rumor we heard ourselves of a woman in town visiting a local who'd been seen at a bar or restaurant. She was described as Puerto Rican, though no one specified how they'd gained that information. The other lead related to migrant farm workers who spent time in Millen on a seasonal basis and had been through in February of 1988. According to the files, the migrant workers who came through Millen that February were a group of American, Mexican, and Central and South American workers. Most spoke English or Spanish, though maybe not all. There's no record of who, if any, might have been part of indigenous populations. Apparently, they'd been hired to plant on the 1st of February and had moved on by the time the Jenkins County Jane Doe was found. The GBI managed to track down that group at their next planting job in McRae, Georgia, nearly 2 hours away. The group members in McRae reported that all the workers hired in Jenkins were still accounted for and had arrived together. Their employer apparently verified this information. Then, on March 18th, a waitress called to say that she'd seen the story on the news and heard mention that the victim might be a migrant planter. A group of migrant planters had been coming into her restaurant in Fairburn, which isn't close to McRae or Millen. It's a couple hours away at least. She worked at a little place, Judy's Restaurant, and said the group she'd seen around traveled with a woman who translated, another planter probably, an American. When the translator was questioned, it was discovered she'd been previously charged with premeditated murder. But she didn't have any apparent connection to Jenkins County. She said no one was missing. It was another dead end. Then came a tip about a missing indigenous woman, Julie McDowell. There was no mention of her tribe, and we can't find any record of her in missing persons databases. We do know that she was from Athens, Georgia, hours north of Millen, and it so happened that a good friend of hers worked in the prison system up there. She happened upon the report of the unidentified woman in Millen and thought that Marla Lawson's sketch favored Julie. She said she hadn't seen Julie in 6 weeks, but said there was no missing persons report on file. However, Julie was ruled out based on a single, viable fingerprint. A Salvation Army shelter employee in Augusta, Georgia, reported that the sketch looked like a woman, Maria G., who'd recently stayed at the shelter. Maria was from Puerto Rico. That's all the worker knew. Even with this limited information, a very thorough search was conducted for Maria, one which involved the Puerto Rican government. They verified that a woman with the same name and birthday existed, but that she wasn't in Puerto Rico at the time the GBI inquired. Further investigation revealed that Maria had last been seen using a shared telephone in the Salvation Army shelter hallway. She'd used another woman's social security number with state services, and though she was not located, her recorded height and weight eventually excluded her as a possible match. There were certainly other tips referencing women of all backgrounds. Marla's sketch had struck a nerve, but not the precise one the investigators needed. People called in to report that they'd met a woman who looked like her at a bar or seen a woman at a restaurant, or gone on a blind date with someone who favored the sketch. Actual details were severely lacking. The GBI looked into sex offenders, kidnappers, anyone with a violent rap sheet who targeted women. There was a brief hope of identification when a tentative connection was made to a man in North Augusta, South Carolina, a man we'll call Sanders, who'd been accused of murdering his own children to collect the life insurance. Law enforcement were told that Sanders had a girlfriend of Asian descent who hadn't been seen, not since the children died. North Augusta acquaintances reported that the sketch and the bedding, especially the pillow, looked familiar. A neighbor reported that Sanders also owned a wheeled duffel-style suitcase and that she'd seen Sanders' children pulling it around, but there were never any connections established. However, the GBI had one other lead, one that, even from early on, seemed like a good one. Eventually, they even had a confession. But there's just one problem. In 2019, the suspect had been dead for 13 years, and his best friend for two. If this suspect killed the Jenkins County Jane Doe, he took the best chance of identifying her with him to his grave. That is, of course, unless people, and there are always people, who knew him, decide to talk. It's been 31 years, enough time, to decide to give a woman back her name. In that interest, we've been given permission to use his. The call came in on February 17th, just 3 days after the Jenkins County Jane Doe was found. The GBI tip line received the following information from a speaker described as a young adult black male. Quote, "I want to tell you about that girl's death. Talk to Johnny Young." Someone ought to talk to Johnny. They also named a friend of Johnny's, a man we'll call Michael, as having a knowledge of the Jenkins County Jane Doe's death. Johnny Jerome Young was 23 years old and from Millen, though he'd spent time in New Jersey. He was a good bit younger than Michael, an assistant pastor at the local church, and he had fewer ties. He'd been traveling for a few weeks before he got back into Millen, by Greyhound, actually. As Michael told it, Johnny had called him on February 9th from Orlando and said he was trying to get back to Millen. He said he needed a ride back from the nearest Greyhound station, so Michael picked him up, and it was reported that Johnny had a suitcase with him, natural enough as he'd been on the road. Michael reported that Johnny had been staying with him since then. Since Johnny had been at Michael's trailer, a number of long-distance calls had been made to New Jersey and to Orlando. There were a high volume of these calls on the 10th and the 12th. The GBI agent in charge first spoke to Michael and Johnny on the 17th, the same day the call came in, and 3 days after the Jenkins County Jane Doe was found. If you'll recall, the dumpsters had been emptied on the 12th. Her estimated day of death was 4 to 7 days before Valentine's Day. The suspect would have to have been in town during that window. But Michael, very specifically, said that Johnny arrived alone, with only his luggage. If he was involved, where did the Jenkins County Jane Doe come from? Did she follow from Florida? Johnny denied knowing her and said he'd take a polygraph. Then he asked something that sent law enforcement on another line of inquiry. He wanted to know if his uncle, who we'll call David, had accused him. Johnny owed David some money and thought it was the kind of thing his uncle might do. That led agents straight to Uncle David, and he had plenty to say. The way he told it, Johnny hung around with two men who were involved in the southeastern drug trade. He offered up his own version of his nephew's extended travels, which had lasted through most of January and part of February. And here's where it gets convoluted. Uncle David claimed that he didn't have this firsthand from Johnny, but rather from a woman who we'll call Betty, who also lived in the mobile home park and who knew them both. According to Uncle David, Betty told him the following. Johnny had gone to Claxton, Georgia, the halfway point between Millen and Savannah. There, Johnny met up with the two men David said he knew as Possum and Legs, who were from Florida. While in Claxton, Legs was purportedly hanging out with a, quote, Puerto Rican girl, whom he took to the Wagon Wheel Club. They'd spent a week or so drinking around town and then decided to head down to Savannah. While they were there, rumor had it that Johnny had stolen all of Legs' money and headed back with it to Millen, plus the girl. Betty said she hadn't seen the girl since then, and Uncle David explained that Betty was afraid that the Jenkins County Jane Doe might be one and the same. He also said that he hadn't made the anonymous call to the GBI on the 12th, the one that put them onto Johnny in the first place. It took a while to sort out that story. When agents questioned Betty, she said she had no idea what they were talking about. She hadn't told any such story. She hadn't said a bit of it, especially not to David. She offered to take a polygraph, but based on the notes we read, it's unclear whether that was actually completed. Workers at the Wagon Wheel Club in Claxton were questioned, but didn't remember anyone matching the Jenkins County Jane Doe's description coming in. Johnny Young was brought in for a second interview on February 22nd. Fugitive status on a New Jersey warrant meant that he could be held for questioning. At this interview, Johnny was read his rights, and his prints were taken. He said that he did know Possum, that they'd at one time been best friends, but that he'd never met Legs. He also said that he'd never dated a Puerto Rican woman and hadn't traveled with any woman at all back from Florida. Ultimately, there were no leads and nothing to connect Johnny Young to the victim. In early 1990, the case became inactive. And that might have been it. A few leads that didn't pan out, and a suspect whose involvement couldn't be proven. Or, if you look at it another way, a person who might very well be innocent, who couldn't be connected to a crime. Except, in July of 1991, the Jenkins County Sheriff, not the GBI, received a very strange phone call. A Deputy Campbell was answering the phones that day. The caller said, "Campbell, you know me. Remember the girl? I'm tired of running." Campbell says he recognized the caller as Johnny Young. The caller went on to say that he was in New Jersey, that he'd tried to turn himself in, but the police there didn't believe him. He wanted Campbell to come up and get him. Then he hung up. Campbell wasn't able to get back in touch. When New Jersey law enforcement tracked down Johnny and visited him at his girlfriend's apartment, he said that he hadn't made the call and denied having anything to do with the murder. However, he implicated several other men from Millen, including his uncle. He said it was these men who'd shown him the dumpster where the body was before the Jenkins County Jane Doe was even discovered. He said they told him the story of killing her. Georgia law enforcement began to re-interview everyone who'd been originally questioned. They began with his friend Michael, now a pastor, the same friend who'd picked him up at the bus station, and from whose house he'd made the collect phone calls. In 1991, Michael told them that on the 14th, he dropped Johnny off at his grandmother's house. By the time Michael picked him up at 9, Johnny knew about the body in the dumpster. But maybe that's not so odd. It was, and is, a very small town. Uncle David got another interview as well. He denied knowing any of the men that Johnny listed off in that New Jersey police interview. It was another 7 years before further movement came, this time in a lab re-examination of the evidence. In 1998, the tape from the suitcase was gone over again. This time, they found brownish gold carpet fiber embedded in the residue. Law enforcement took carpet samples from Michael's carpet, which he said he hadn't changed since 1988. But the results were not consistent. The house was mostly carpeted in red. Only the bedroom was brownish gold. Michael insisted that he hadn't changed out any other brownish gold carpeting. He said he no longer had the Buick Regal he'd picked Johnny up in. He did suggest, though, that the bag Johnny'd had at the Greyhound station was large enough to put a body in. the case could not move forward unless Johnny Young or whoever was claiming to be him called again or new evidence arose. They were all in a holding pattern. That call never came. In fact, Johnny Young remained in New Jersey, dying there in 2004. His obituary says that he was buried in Millen, in the same cemetery where Michael, his friend, an alibi, was buried in 2017. We don't know why or even if Johnny called and confessed. The case was inactive then, so the pressure wouldn't have been on. But that doesn't account for the dozens of reasons his uncle or someone else might point the blame his way again. He'd done it before. Johnny said over money, David over guilt. There's just no way to tell. How do you solve the case of an unidentified woman 31 years after the victim was found, when the only clear suspect is dead, when the friend who corroborated his story has died too? For Special Agent in Charge Durden and Special Agent Peak, it's like every other cold case. You start at the beginning. We asked them to walk us through that process.
As you can tell, that case file is 4 volumes, so it's very lengthy. And the main thing is absorbing that information, because I wasn't there when this case was going on, to get in that agent's shoes to see what he was seeing from a mental aspect. I have a notepad that I have all my cases that are active, and I'll basically start with names and what their involvement was. It keeps me, I guess, in line, because we work so many cases that you got so many names that go through your head, so many interviews, that it's hard to keep track of everything and when the dates and stuff like that. So I keep a notebook that's got the names of everybody involved, the date they were interviewed, what their role is and everything. And I kind of look at it, and it refreshes my mind to filter through the case file. But really absorbing all that information and basically jot notes of what needs to be done, what hadn't been done, or someone that needs to be re-interviewed. And that's the main thing. And really, with a case like this, is tracking down these people that 30 years ago, are these people still in this area? Who's still alive? Who's not still alive? You know, stuff like that. So it's really absorbing all that information and figuring out what needs to happen first.
And to add to that, there's a lot to be said by being there when it happened. I've worked a lot of murder cases, and I've assumed a lot of murder cases. The ones that I take over from somebody else, you don't have the mental visual reference. When Dustin goes and visits, he may have already gone there. When he goes and visits this dumpster, he gets a sense of being there. He gets to see it. He gets to think. And the way I work these is I go to the dumpster and I say, if I'm going to kill a person and dump in the body, what am I going to do? And how am I going to do this? Which way am I going to travel? Where am I going to go? Why would I do it here? What's the deal here? You don't get that unless you're there. And plus, looking into people's eyes and talking to them sometimes on these people they've interviewed, you get an idea if they're lying or not. It does not have that benefit. Plus the evidence in this case. We got a room, boxes full of evidence that he's never opened yet. And seeing that in the beginning stages in the dumpster is different than pulling it out of a box. So being able to see from that standpoint, he's at a great disadvantage. It's almost an impossible disadvantage. This happened, I think we joked about it a while ago. Dustin was not even born when this case happened. So it's amazing, really, that you're taking somebody that wasn't even living at the time to go solve this case.
And if I can just add something else, Agent Hill that worked the case, he's probably the best for me, is taking a unsolved case like this. He's probably my best point of contact I could go to. You know, ask him, you know, what were you feeling at the time? You know, how was this? And basically, he can tell me how he felt and who he talked to and what he think happened. And I try to do that with all my cases. I have tried to, just as Special Agent Charlie Durden said earlier, people leave offices, maybe go back to Atlanta or wherever they're from. And I think the best thing to do is contact that agent and meet with them, go over the case with them and document everything they tell you. I mean, that's really the best thing you can do when you get a case like this.
And that's one of the things he's going to do, is go contact Agent Hill and Agent Gillis, the two that were working this. And I've already talked to the agent that was in charge during the time, Charles Sykes, on the case, and he gave me his insight. And so I've done my part, so he'll go meet with these agents and say, hey, what are you thinking? What do you think? Because there's a lot of things that happen in a case that's not in the file. Mm-hmm. You know, gut feeling of the agent. Or he can say, yeah, this Johnny guy did it, no doubt. And I just can't prove it, and that helps him focus. My experience of growing up in the same area helps me. I know what people think and how they think. And going and looking at people in the eyes and figuring out, looking at their carotid artery when they're talking, you know, things like that. You see that he doesn't have the advantage to do now. But based on the gut feeling, you know, when you talk to somebody or when you go to a scene, the way I've always done it, when I go to a murder scene, and it's worked out good. I know this is kind of strange to say, but I put myself in the shoes of the killer. I'm not as warped, but we all have it deep inside of us somewhere. And I try to say, okay, if I was going to kill this person, first of all, how would I do it? Why would I put them in this bag? Why would I strangle them this way? Whatever. And where would I go after I did that? Which route would I go? Where would I go? Where's the first house? I try to stress to all the newer agents is don't forget your training. Don't forget what you do, what you're trained to do, but always put yourself in the shoes of a killer and see what he would do. And how would you get rid of this body?
So when you think about this specific case, when we knew that this woman was like unidentified, one of the most interesting things to us is all of the different bedding and stuff that was found with her. Do you have a gut feeling about that? Did you find it interesting that there was so much bedding with her in the bag?
Yes. Well, part of the bedding is probably to wrap her up in. It's easy to transport somebody that's wrapped. And some of that's wrapped. It tightens her up. Maybe, you know, the bedding could be used to tighten her up to get her in that suitcase because the suitcase was small. And so that could have been used for that. You know, the bedding, it could have come from wherever she came from. That could have been her favorite bedding and travel. She could have come from a motel room. She could have come from her own house. She could have come into another house, and that's another person's bedding. There's several, many options. I agree it is special bedding. We talked before this, and this is not something that the suspect was probably going to carry around with him, and I think it belonged to her. And probably once we get it out, we'll end up finding more hair of her within this bedding or more DNA samples in this bedding. But it is a significant thing, and it was a significant thing there. If you read the case file, the agent he was concerned about this bedding. He actually tried to track it back to the manufacturers, Korea maybe, I think, some of it. And so it was important to know where that came from, to know where she came from.
It looked like there was a pillow in there that didn't have any blood on it.
Yep.
Which is like, why would you include the pillow?
That's all part of thinking it through, intuition. And like you said it before we turned the recorder on, that's odd that this bedding is there. And that means that she was attached to this somehow or another. And it's kind of like I call it the dead man's glue, something she left for us. And it's our job to figure out why that's important. So what I'd like people to know is that these things are harder to solve than they seem to be on TV. If you watch a lot of TV, the crime programs, these things are solvable. Yeah, they are on TV because they got 10 people working on one case for an hour, really, but it's 6 months. We don't have that luxury. We have one person working on it, and they're very busy. And so it's just they can't focus all their attention on this case. So I'd like the public to know these things are not easy to solve. They're old. We got to gather all the evidence. Back when they started, DNA didn't exist, and all this forensic stuff now, touch DNA or any of that stuff, didn't exist like it exists now. So we're trying to go back and piece together something that they didn't even know to collect back then. You know, now it's important to us. And so that it's harder than it looks. It's harder than it seems to go back and piece this together. Plus, most of the people that you have to go back and talk to are either dead or they don't want to talk to you. And so you got to basically work magic. And the second part of your question was, and what can people do? You know, my thing is to call us. The reason I'm talking to you all is I want to develop further leads on this. If somebody's listening to us and they know about this case, call us with good information. I need somebody that says, hey, I lived in that area. I saw this. I know that. I want to talk to you about this. That's the kind of leads that we can go follow. And that's a showstopper, I'll call it. If we get calls like that, I say, we're all going. I'm going. We're going to go figure out because that's a hot lead. And we're going to explore that. Hot leads, I guess, is what I'm looking for. Or any kind of idea. Most of your listeners are going to come up. They're crime stoppers or crime investigators. They're going to give us an idea. Call us, give an idea. And say, hey, have you checked this? Have you checked that? Nope, we'll do it.
For now, the focus of the investigation lies in fresh interviews and an accounting of the evidence. So the regional office has requested that all the remaining samples and evidence from the case be sent directly to them. With thousands of cases and decades of material, the vast majority of evidence is kept in off-site storage. As of March of 2019, Special Agent in Charge Durden says that they have sent out the evidence that is in the office for fresh testing and are awaiting to receive dental records and other such materials that have been in storage. Regarding the possible testing of cremains, we spoke with Dr. Amy Michael, an assistant professor in anthropology at the University of New Hampshire. Dr. Michael has a special interest in forensic anthropology and uses cold cases to instruct her students. Her area of specialty is microstructure and bone and teeth, and she gave us some insight into what could still be accomplished in the Jenkins Doe case. One of the first and most interesting things that she explained was that a 1988 cremation would actually have higher chances of containing material that could be studied. She told us, quote, "Modern cremation processes significantly damage remains, but not for the reasons you may think. Even long-term burning at high temperatures does not totally destroy bone." Dr. Michael pointed out that Jenkins County very well could have been using an older process. If fragments remain, they could still be useful, though not for DNA and eventual identification. She explained that, quote, "Burning bone does not significantly change the microstructure of the bone, which means that the fragments could still be examined to get a closer determination of age." Dr. Michael is especially interested in whether teeth or dental x-rays remain, and the GBI are still working on those, because they can be a tool in identifying ancestral groups. We don't want to end where we started, with a woman in a dumpster. She belongs somewhere, to a place, or a people, or a family. There has to be someone who marked her absence, even if they thought she'd gone of her own volition. So maybe you can be the person who can answer that call. Make sure to look at our forensic sketch. It's on our social media and our website. You don't have to be from the Southeast. She could truly be from anywhere. If you know the woman known as the Jenkins County Jane Doe, please call the GBI. And if you have information pertaining to Johnny Young or anyone else who may have been responsible for her death, you can also contact the GBI, 912-871-1121. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard and to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're grateful. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Haley Gray, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrill. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Mara Curry. Line editing by Bill Bertschinger. Remastered by Scott Stronach. Special content advisement by Dr. Catherine Hyun. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd and Sarah Turney. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the services of PIs.